you'll see that America is still the land of the free.
Welcome to the Voice of Freedom, your national beacon of liberty. Now, here's your Voice of Freedom, Brent Johnson.
Steve Keen is Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney. Author of the best-selling book Debunking Economics, he differs from the norm for critics of conventional economics by being highly mathematical in his research. His main research interest is in developing mathematical models of Hyman Minsky's financial instability hypothesis. He earned both his Ph.D. in economics and his Master's in Commerce Honors in Economics and Economic History from the University of New South Wales. It is my pleasure to welcome to the Global Freedom Report, Professor Stephen Keen. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thanks, Brent.
I recently saw you on Russia Today TV News. You were speaking about economics very differently than most economists today, which is what attracted my attention to you in the first place. In what ways do your views on economics in general differ from the established standard?
Well, it's one of those things that if you had 3 hours, I could answer the question, but the brief answer is quite paradoxical, and that is the dominant school of thought in economics these days is called neoclassical. People think it's Keynesian, but it's actually the general term is called neoclassical economics. One of the great ironies I've realized while writing the second edition of Debunking Economics is that neoclassical economists don't understand neoclassical economics. In other words, they have a superficial view of their own theory of how the economy operates, which sees this coherent idea about markets being in equilibrium, supply balancing demand, and everything being about markets functioning very, very well. And in fact, their own research proves that they're wrong on those fronts, and yet they carry on as if they're right. And one thing that it causes them to do, which is fundamental to why they didn't see the crisis that we're now in coming, is that they completely ignore the role of private debt. So they think as though the level of private debt has no impact on the economy, and the only part of debt they worry about is government debt. They are unfortunately profoundly wrong, especially when the private sector gets heavily involved in what you can basically call a Ponzi scheme, which is what's been driving the American economy fundamentally for the last decade. The falsity of their analysis in the first instance and their blind spot to the role of debt in the functioning of the economy are why they're so profoundly wrong about the economy. And of course, consequently, I take both those issues into account.
Is that singular aspect of private debt so significant to create a disparity between your views and the norm, the standard, the neoclassical?
Yes, it is. The simplest way I can illustrate that is to talk about the level of demand in an economy. If you come from a conventional perspective, then what they call the neoclassical view, and it's also very common in what's called the Austrian view of economics as well, they argue that aggregate demand in the economy fundamentally is aggregate supply. In other words, if you're going to buy something, you have to sell something first. And that sounds quite plausible to most people, and that's the starting point for the way that most economists reason about the economy. And they say that debt doesn't matter because they say, well, you know, if a bank's going to lend somebody money, they have to have it deposited by a saver in the first place. So the saver's spending power goes down, the borrower's spending power goes up, and in the aggregate, there's no impact from the level of debt on aggregate demand. That is empirically false because we now know after 40 years of quite solid empirical research by such radical people as the Federal Reserve Board, and in particular a governor back in the days of monetarism under Milton Friedman, they say that banks create money simply by double-entry bookkeeping. They don't need to have a saver before they can lend money. When they issue a loan to a borrower, they deposit, say, $1 million in the borrower's account, and they record that the borrower owes them $1 million, and that actually generates spending power. That's the theoretical reason why they're wrong. The empirical scale of that is that aggregate demand is therefore aggregate supply plus the change in debt. Now, that in the American economy in 2007, before the crisis began, aggregate supply, the output of the American economy, is roughly $14 trillion. But the increase in debt that year was over $4 trillion. Now that means over 25% of the demand in the economy was generated by the change in debt. That was then spent both on buying commodities, of course, but also on buying assets, houses, and the flip that house frenzy that we call the subprime crisis, and also on the stock market as well. But that was a $4 trillion boost to demand over what it would have been without the change in debt. At the other end, when you had the collapse in demand as the crisis really unfolded and people were desperately trying to reduce their debt, given the potential of going bankrupt, That reduced demand by $1.5 trillion. So you went from being a $14 trillion economy to a $12.5 trillion economy. That's why you had a crisis. That's why it's significant.
Now, I'm something of a mathematician. I was something of a math prodigy in my day, so I can relate to the idea that you are highly mathematical in your research. How do you apply mathematical principles to your general approach to economics?
Well, the basic story there is that I've been trained in what you might call biological mathematics, the mathematics of biological systems, differential equations, processes of change over time, and I specialized in what's called complexity theory. So you work in the area where you have a system which has nonlinear feedbacks. So if you imagine, say, a population of fish, which has absolutely no sharks and an infinite supply of seagrass to eat, that population will, of course, explode exponentially. But if you then have a population of sharks there as well, then they will eat the fish, grow to a very large number, reduce the fish down to almost, they disappear, the sharks then starve, the fish then grow again, and you get to call it a nonlinear feedback system. Well, that foundation of thought says that you've got to look at a system out of equilibrium with feedbacks that cause complex cycles you wouldn't expect out of a straightforward linear way of thinking. And that's really what I've applied to economics as well. So it's a very, very broad area of scientific research these days called complexity theory. And most economists have ignored it because it requires them to think outside the box of believing everything happens in equilibrium. So the people I criticize, the neoclassicals, are also highly mathematical, but they've developed an absolutely bizarre sub-branch of mathematics where everything happens in equilibrium. And that is just not the real economy in which we live.
What exactly is the Hyman-Minsky financial instability hypothesis?
That's a very realistic starting point for looking at an economy, because Hyman-Minsky said that whatever you might have as an ideological position about whether capitalism is better than socialism or whatever else, you have to admit that capitalism has depressions, has financial crises. And therefore, if you're going to have an adequate model of how a capitalist economy functions, your model must have, as one of the potential states of the economy, a financial crisis. If you can't have that, according to Hyman, you are not modeling capitalism. And that, I thought, was an eminently sensible starting point for looking at how the economy operates. So his vision begins from saying that if you think in historical terms, historical time, at some time in the recent past, there would have been a financial crisis. And we also, of course, living in the real world, don't know the future. Therefore, we have uncertainty about the future, and our expectations about what's going to happen in the future will be, to some extent, inordinately affected by what's happening right now. So if things are depressed, we'll feel depressed. If things are booming, we'll feel good. Starting from that point in the aftermath of a crisis, both borrowers and lenders will be very conservative about going into debt, because there's recently been a debt-induced crisis. That means that the only projects they'll put forward for investment for funding will be conservatively estimated projects. Now, because the economy's got through that crisis, most of those projects are going to succeed. Because they succeed, both borrowers and lenders look at what they did last time and think, oh, we were a bit too conservative. If we'd borrowed more money, we would have made a larger leveraged gain. So Hyman has a brilliant phrase to paraphrase what happens as a result of this. He says, in a market economy with complex financial institutions and an uncertain future, a period of stability is destabilizing. In other words, if you have a period of tranquil growth in a capitalist economy, that will lead to people having rising expectations. They're willing to take riskier positions. And of course, we've all seen this happen over the last 20 or 30 years, in particular after the 87 stock market crash, through the telecoms bubble and the dot-com bubble, into the subprime bubble and so on. Each time we do that, people then become more willing to borrow money and gamble both on asset prices and, to some extent, also sensible investments. What that then generates is an environment where there are rising asset prices. And with rising asset prices, it's possible for people like Charles Keating to come along and all the innumerable number of people you could attempt to name for the subprime crisis, who'd make money by borrowing money and buying assets on a rising market. And those people are Minsky calls Ponzi financiers. Now, the memory of the old Charles Ponzi, we call them Madoff financiers, but people who make money simply by buying and selling assets on a rising market. And their cash flow is less than their debt servicing costs, and they only profit because asset prices continue to rise. But because they're simply buying and selling assets, they're adding to debt level without adding to the productive capacity of the economy. And they're also driving up the demand for funds and pushing up interest rates. So at some point, that causes a crisis when there's too much debt, or you get people who had conservatively, sensibly worked out investments which were now made less profitable by rising interest rates. So they then sell their assets into the market. That stops the exponential growth of asset prices, and you have a collapse. And then you're back where you started from. But what you've got to is a process where that gives you a period of ratcheting up of the level of debt over time. because when you go back to the revival again, the revival will start with a high level of debt. And ultimately, you'll get to the stage where so much debt is taken on that the whole economy simply can't cope with it. You have a crisis not just of liquidity but solvency, and you fall into a depression.
The Keynesian or neoclassical system of economics has been used for decades. It seems to be based, in its simplest form, on the premise that the more we go into debt, the healthier our economies are. Isn't that a bit crazy? And if so, how is it that Keynesian economic theory has had a hold on governments and banking and financial institutions all over the world for so long? And what can be done to shake loose some common sense in the face of Keynesian economics?
Well, what people call Keynesian economics is not Keynesian. In fact, the analogy I use often is that the people who call themselves Keynesian, people like Paul Krugman, for example, if they can call themselves Keynesian, then I can call myself a duck because I can say the word quack. In other words, their founding and what Keynes was actually talking about is trivial, and their knowledge of Keynes is almost non-existent. They simply use that as a label. The real school they come from is what's called neoclassical school, the economics. And there you have two divisions within neoclassical. One, a bunch who call themselves new Keynesians, who, as I was just argued, know nothing about Keynes. And the other side, a bunch of them who call themselves new classicals, who, in my opinion, know nothing about the classical school of economics either. They're both just small, slightly different subsects of neoclassical economics. Now, when it comes to their attitude to debt, the ones that call themselves Keynesians argue that the government should debt finance the economy to some extent when there's a downturn. The other side argue the economy should always be in perfect balance and there should be no government at all. I think both of those are a false dichotomy, and both are ignoring the empirical dynamics of the economy. And there's far too much ideology in what people practice in economics. And both of them have an ideological belief that the market economy operates either brilliantly or really well, without saying, let's how see it actually operates empirically and forget about whether we try to label it as good or bad. It isn't that the Keynesians argue you should run more and more debt. Like Krugman, for example, will argue right now that the government should debt spend. And I agree with him, by the way. I'll discuss that in a moment, if you like, in the particular circumstance. But their reasoning for that automatically ignores what got us into this situation of rising government debt right now, which was collapsing private debt. To just give you an idea of the numbers, the level of private debt in America in 2007-2008 hit three times your GDP. Back in 1945, your level of debt to GDP was about 50% of GDP. So the American economy has gone from carrying half a year's private debt in terms of its GDP to 3 years over the last 60 years. Now, that was an unsustainable level of debt. And then when you had the crisis hitting in 2007-2008, the private sector went from leveraging up, increasing its debt levels, to leveraging down. So it's gone from about 300% of GDP to 270% of GDP, the 30% of GDP fall. That's what's caused your government debt to start blowing up. And to focus on saying the government debt's the problem, it's a bit like saying that putting a Band-Aid over a wound is the problem. The problem was the wound in the first instance, which is the private sector debt. Now, in that situation, when you have the private sector reducing its debt level, what it's therefore doing is also reducing the amount of money in circulation in the economy. If the government goes ahead and does exactly the same thing at the same time, you have two wounds being hit to the body rather than one. So there is a good reason when there's a crisis like that for the government to spend to create the money that's actually been taken out of the economy by the private sector reducing its debt levels. However, that's not the full solution. And because the neoclassicals ignore the level of private debt, they think all you've got to do is debt spend and the economy will function more properly. And of course, we're seeing that's not the case.
I'm a big believer in some kind of an Austrian-type system or a pay-as-you-go system in which incurring debt is a rare exception rather than the general rule. What's wrong with my idea for a strong economy that you don't buy something you can't afford?
So let's start to answer that question by starting from an Austrian, which is Joseph Schumpeter, who I regard as the greatest of the Austrian economists, and most Austrians don't want to admit that he was an Austrian. Schumpeter argued that if you start from an economy in perfect equilibrium, where the only way you can buy anything is by selling something and so on, so there's no debt levels, he said what you need to get growth out of that situation is entrepreneurial activity. He said, by definition, an entrepreneur is somebody with an idea, but not necessarily with the money to put that idea into operation. We all know how Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started Apple by selling their combi van to raise the money to build the first Apples. But let's just presume that they actually went to a bank instead to borrow the money, and many, many firms do that. For example, the Tesla motor car in America right now has been substantially debt financed to start innovating a very advanced electric car. So an entrepreneur, from Schumpeter's point of view, is somebody who has an idea but not money. Well, to put their idea into operation, they have to raise money without having sold goods to get that money in the first instance. Their source for that revenue is debt. They go to a bank, they say, we've got a brilliant idea. The bank says, that's a great idea. I think I'm willing to risk $1 million on it. And by the way, you owe us $1 million. So innovation, in the proper sense of how a capitalist economy should function, and one of the great strengths of the capitalist economy, is that it provides that innovation. It comes from expanding debt. But what that money should be used to do is then produce new technology, new commodities, better ways of producing existing commodities or opening up new markets, not gambling and rising asset prices. But the reason we're in the crisis now is that legitimate use of debt has become a sideshow in the American financial system, and instead you spend all your money gambling and rising asset prices, which is counterproductive.
That's kind of what I meant when I said debt being the exception rather than the rule, because it seems like today you go into debt just to make money.
That's right, and that's totally false. Partly it's because if you think about the position of a bank in a properly functioning capitalist economy, what they provide should be two things: working capital for existing corporations, what used to be called lines of credit, which is an essential part of the operation of a normal firm, and money for investment. That's really as far as they should go. They shouldn't be financing buying shares on margin or buying houses with 120% loan to valuation mortgages and crap like that. But that's what they've got into. Now, the reason that they've got into that is because if they actually simply provide working capital and funds for new innovation, in the American economy, it seems that results in a level of debt between 50 and 100% of GDP. Now, if you look at the spread that exists between the cost of funds and the loans that banks make out, that gives you about a 4% of the maximum margin. So the level of finance profits in America, if the finance sector was just doing what it should do, would be 4 to 5% of GDP. Instead, it's about 40%. Now, how they managed to get that larger share of GDP, it's by convincing us to go into debt to gamble on asset prices. Because if you think about it, and you're quite right about it, I'm sure we have the same perspective here, debt per se is not a good thing. Debt to me is a bit like going to the dentist to have a tooth removed. You don't want to have more teeth removed than is necessary. But if the dentist actually makes money by pulling a tooth, then how does he persuade you to take out more teeth than you really should? He tells you, you look sexier with less teeth. Now, fundamentally, that's what the banks have been doing. They say, you'll make money by borrowing money and gambling and rising asset prices. But the result is that that actual gambling and rising asset price is what causes the asset prices to rise. It's one of those positive feedback loops that having a biological mathematical orientation makes obvious to you. Because you borrow the money, you go and buy the asset, you borrowed more money than you would have had without the debt, of course, so you pay a higher price for the asset, you drive the prices up, and that sets off a positive feedback because that means somebody else will think, oh, I'll borrow more money and buy those assets and I'll benefit from the rising asset price too. Of course, what gives you a huge asset bubble, it finally bursts when people look at the level of debt required to get in and say, no thanks, I won't borrow that money. And the supply of new borrowers dries up. And with any Ponzi scheme, it collapses. And we have the crisis we're in now.
Well, now you just described two, I would say, mutually exclusive systems. One in which debt is simply used to try and make money. It doesn't work. Ultimately, it collapses. The other in which debt is used to help legitimately expand the economy through innovation and entrepreneurial activities. How do you get from the one to the other? How do we change what has been going on for decades into something that has a resemblance to a sane economic system?
What we normally do in that situation is we bring in regulation to try to control bankers. And that's what the Glass-Steagall Act was back in 1933. If people want to have a really good look at this, look at the book called The Hellhound of Wall Street that describes the Pecora Commission back in 1932, at beginning of 33, that legitimized Glass-Steagall and gave us that attempt to separate wholesale banking from retail banking and force the bankers to focus upon lending for legitimate reasons rather than lending for speculation. But the trouble is, it was still possible to lend for speculation. And because that's how banks make more money than they should make, they'll entice us into that. And back in 1999, it was seen as a brilliant idea under the Clinton administration to abolish Glass-Steagall. So regulations will work temporarily, but as we get lulled by the very stability those regulations bring about, leaving the banks with a possibility to finance speculation will get us back in trouble again. So my solutions are quite weird when you first hear them, And that is that I want to redefine financial assets to make it far less desirable for people to take on excessive levels of debt to speculate on asset prices. Because you're never going to stop the banks wanting to do that. They're always going to want to lend money. They're always going to want, therefore, to encourage you to get into borrowing money for asset schemes. So I have two proposals. One I call Jubilee Shares. And that is to redefine shares so that if you buy a share of a company, like in an IPO or a new share issue, that share lasts and behaves just like shares do now. But if the share is bought off another speculator, then the share lasts 50 years. And then in 50 years' time, it expires. And the whole idea behind that is that if you wanted to get an indefinite stream of dividends, you'd have to provide money to a firm. But if you're going to buy a share off another speculator, which of course doesn't give money to the firm, then that lasts 50 years, in which case you'd be pretty foolish to borrow money to buy that share. And that would remove leverage from the secondary market and shares. And the second proposal I call the PIL, which stands for Property Income Limited Leverage. And the idea there being that rather than basing the amount of money you can lend to a borrower to buy a property on the basis of the borrower's income, the amount of money that can be borrowed is limited to some factor of the income of the property being purchased, which means if you and I are both fighting over a particular property, which say had a rental value of $50,000 a year, neither of us could borrow more than $500,000 to buy it. And therefore, if you wanted to beat me, you'd need to put in more of your own money to buy it, which would put a negative feedback loop between the level of leverage and the price of housing. And those two factors, I hope, would prevent people being willing to take on excessive levels of debt to gamble and therefore force banks to make money the only way they should make money, which is by financing working capital and investment.
Is there really an existing global economy, or is that term only representative of an ethereal concept, a virtual economy, maybe a gestalt?
There is certainly a globally interconnected economy. I think we have an economy where there's far too much focus on what the neoclassical economists call comparative advantage, so they encourage us to have more trade and less local production, and I think that's false. It's a false way of running an economy because it means that you start having firms exploiting wage differentials rather than producing locally, trying to make money without having local costs, which is destructive of the productive capacity, particularly the American economy. That's why your production has been shifted so much to China in the last 20 or 30 years. So there is a global economy, but I think the idea of a post-industrial economy is a myth, and that's one that I certainly knock very happily and very regularly.
Like a nation itself, an economy has certain borders. The economy of my household does not extend to the next county or the next state or whatever. It's a self-contained unit. From that perspective, is there really a global economy, or is global economy just the term that we apply to the fact that there is so much interconnectivity between the varying economies of the world?
I think the latter is correct. You're right. It's just a term we apply to say there's interconnectivity. But in fact, that interconnectivity has gone probably too far, because a lot of that has been based on trying to reduce the cost of production by shifting production overseas and selling back into the same market that you were selling a mass market into previously. But by relocating production, as many American countries did to take advantage of low wage costs, particularly in China, they no longer hire American labor. They hire Chinese labor instead, pay them one-tenth as much as the American labor, and then try to sell back into the American market. But of course, they've undercut part of the mass market that you used to have, where Ford Motor Car sold some of its cars to Ford employees. You don't, therefore, have the mass market. And the only way that the American consumer can buy those goods is by going into debt. And of course, that ends up being in the situation we're in now. So it's an unsustainable trend. So I'd rather see us move back away from the level of globalization we've had and have more domestically sourced production and not have this attempt to undercut costs that, in a way, American corporations have done in the last 40 years.
What roles do precious metals, specifically gold and silver, play in economics?
I'm not a great fan of gold and silver. I know that there's a great way to make money out of them right now, and people have made a large amount of money buying them in a rising market. That's quite feasible as a commodity speculation. What I found behind it is people believe that they should be money. They think the basis of money should be some physical commodity like gold or silver, and everything would be okay if we had a gold standard or a silver standard. That's where I part company. Because from a historical point of view, fundamentally money has always been a relationship, a non-commodity rather than a commodity. And to be money as it should be, it should have the capacity to expand on demand when you've got a crush of entrepreneurial ideas coming forward. As Schumpeter explained very well, you tend to get these things passing in waves and you necessarily have cycles coming out of it. So there'll be periods of expanded demand and other periods of slackening demand when there's a small slump following the boom. not the sort of depression we're going through now, but just the usual ups and downs of a trade cycle. That is very, very hard for a commodity like gold or silver to supply. And therefore, you tend to get crises caused by inadequate supplies of the metal at vital times, or the price instability of the metal going in the opposite direction to the need for its availability. So I don't see gold and silver as having to take special positions in the economy. And in that sense, I agree with Keynes, who used to describe gold as that barbarous relic. But it's certainly a barbarous relic people have made lots of money out of, and good luck to them.
Let me expand on that a little bit. Gold and silver have inherent value. You can take gold or silver pretty much anywhere in the world, go to the most remote tribes in the jungles of South America, and you show them your gold, and they will trade with you. It has inherent value, regardless of how it is valued in the various economies. So isn't not having gold and silver as a standard opening the door to the kind of rampant, let's just print money forever and ever because it's not backed by anything, tendencies that, say, the U.S. and the Federal Reserve, as well as other modern economies, have engaged in?
That's one of the typical things that happens in economics. People put forward a hypothetical as a preferred system. I'm skeptical about that hypothetical. People look back and say, like, we had a gold standard in the past. We had trade cycles and financial crises when we had gold standards in the 19th century, just as regularly as we had them now. It wasn't a halcyon period. It had been so much better than what we've got now, then why would we go from that to the system we have today? I think gold, in that sense, is overrated as a way of stabilizing the financial system. And think about the example you gave. Take gold off to a primitive culture and they'll accept it. In some ways, that's why Keynes called it a barbarous relic, because he's saying you're relying upon something which will be accepted by people from any other society, when in fact the mark of a civilized society is that you accept a promise of a banking system. Fundamentally, there's some very good arguments on this front which have been summarized by a European group who called themselves the Circuitists, and a guy called Augusto Graziani put it best, and he said that if you want to differentiate a monetary economy from a barter economy, the type of system you and I live in from the system of that primitive village somewhere, then the monetary economy differs from a barter economy because what they use for exchange is not a commodity. Otherwise, it's fundamentally the same to barter. On that basis, you've always had money being effectively a promise of a third party to pay, the third party being the bank. The problem is that that third party gets corrupted by the power that promise gives it, particularly when it can encourage us into asset bubbles. I think it's a fundamental innate part of the nature of a market economy that it uses fundamentally a promise to enable exchange to occur. But the trouble is they become wild by letting that same promise be used to distort the system through funding asset bubbles. Ultimately, if you went to gold and silver, fundamentally we don't mean that I'd be buying my books from Amazon by sending them a sliver of gold through the mail to get it sent back to me from the United States when I'm in Sydney, Australia. What we're talking about is using gold certificates. Now, we're still effectively relying upon a promise that said this thing matches what I've got in my gold vault somewhere, and then electronic transfers and so on and matching it to the gold. I simply don't believe that system would hold together. I think the same potential is still there and the commodity basis would break down. I've just got the skepticism coming from a bit of a historical perspective on what the function and role of money has been in the market economy, and it never has really been a commodity.
Maybe we should go back to tally sticks. That worked pretty well for 700 years. What do you foresee, what would you predict for the immediate and the long-term future for the United States and the European Union economies?
We're in a long-run depression, similar to what Japan's in, and for much the same reason, and that is this huge level of debt borrowed for speculation, where the private debt should never have been extended in the first place, but we're still trying to honor this private debt. And therefore, we have the private sector, in America in particular, that is effectively insolvent. We say the debts of that insolvent sector should be honored. Well, you can't honor insolvent debts. A good colleague of mine, Michael Hudson, coined a perfect phrase for this to say that the fundamental truth is the debts that can't be repaid won't be repaid. If you insist upon them being repaid, you'll end up in a permanent crisis. So I think that's where we're going to be, and we'll get turnarounds in that crisis at various times, which are caused by a thing I call the credit accelerator, which I'll explain in a moment. What people are currently trying to do is to honour debt that should never have been honoured, and largely it's been by transferring it from the private sector to the public sector and then trying to control public sector spending, which means we'd have a private sector not spending because it's trying to delever and a public sector trying to pay its debt down. Simultaneously, both of those are sucking money out of the economy. So I expect we're going to see a continuous downturn, and in particular in Europe, austerity will fail and lead to a worsening situation, and in fact lead to budgets that are even more poorly balanced than initially, because driving down the cash flows by trying to cut the surplus will reduce the GDP and reduce the tax take and end up with the same level of deficit but a lower level of income. In America, what you're going through now is the volatility of what I call the credit accelerator. And that comes back to the argument earlier about aggregate demand being income or GDP plus the change in debt. That therefore means the change in aggregate demand is the change in GDP plus the acceleration of debt. And that's what's happening in America right now. You're still reducing the debt levels, but you're reducing the debt level more slowly. And that's given a big boost to the economy, which is part of why you had a reduction in unemployment in the last year and a half to 2 years. That now is reaching a turning point. And when that turning point goes in the opposite direction, I think you'll go back to rapidly falling debt again. So the acceleration will be negative once more, and you'll have rising unemployment. That's the trap that you're falling into now, which is why Ben Bernanke had to admit he didn't understand why the economy wasn't responding. It's because they're ignoring the dynamics of debt, and that's what's causing the crisis.
We've been visiting with Professor Steve Keen, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Western Sydney, Australia, and author of the best-selling book, Debunking Economics. If you'd like more information about how to get the book or about the work that Professor Keen is doing, go to www.debunkingeconomics.com. Additionally, he has a blog at www.debtdeflation.com/blogs. Professor Keen, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
It's been a pleasure, Brent. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this edition of The Voice of Freedom. Opinions expressed are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the views of Truth and Freedom Radio Networks, Freedom Broadcast Group Incorporated, or our sponsors. For more information about your freedoms and liberties, or to contact Brent, just log on to our website at www.freedomradio.us or call 1-888-385-3733. Join us next time for another lesson in liberty on The Voice of Freedom.
America, land of the free, right to life and liberty. Open your eyes and you will see that America is still the land of the free.